Oh, yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
We'll hear argument this morning in case 1946, United States Patent and Trademark Office versus Booking.com.
That's the Supreme Court gaveling in the oral arguments today via conference call. The first time the court has ever heard arguments this way, and the first time the public could listen in live. We're going to talk more about the court's historic day coming up. First, we're going to look at what's happening in education. Most college students are taking classes remotely and from home. Some have received a break on dorm and meal fees, but not for tuition or other fees. And now a class action lawsuit against both the UC and Cal State system says they should refund those fees, fees that go for things like gyms and healthcare centers. Adam Levitt joins me now. He's one of the lawyers suing UC and Cal State on behalf of some 700,000 students. Adam, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so you're not suing for a tuition refund, but you are suing for a fee refund. And how much money are we talking about?
Well, if you look at what these fees are across the board in the Cal State system, the annual fees range from about $800 to about $4,000+. And in the University of California system, they range from between $3,000 to about $5,000. So it's a very substantial amount of money, even if you're only speaking about a quarter of that. And I'll walk you through that. And that is, one semester is 50% of an annual fee, and half of a semester is a quarter of an annual fee. So even if you're only speaking about a quarter of an annual fee, in terms of these fees I mentioned, and let's actually focus on the University of California fees and pick a midpoint of, let's say, $4,000. One quarter of that is $1,000, and there are 260,000 students in that system. So you don't need to be a math major to understand that that adds up pretty quickly.
Well, Cal State, we've heard back from them, and Cal State says they are returning some of these fees, that is part of their policy, and they're looking at that right now and refunding certain fees like parking, for example, and they're looking at other ways to refund the money if, in fact, they're not providing these services. So does that go towards resolving your complaint?
Well, to the extent that our lawsuits have been serving as a catalyst for Cal State or the University of California to reconsider the positions it's been taking so far, well, that's certainly a positive thing. The fact is that even if they want to say that they're giving a little bit back here, or even if they're saying, for example, because we've actually heard this from one of the university system's statements, that they're offering a telehealth option or whatever it is, that's going to be a fraction and an easily calculable fraction of the overall amount of fees that they're still hanging on to. So we're going to need to actually see what each of the university systems produces to us in discovery as our lawsuits go on, and we'll see exactly what this is all about. The bottom line is that we've heard from hundreds of students and families since we've put these cases on file, and every single story is they aren't giving us back our campus fees, we're out lots of money, and especially at this point in time in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis, where, as we all know, so many families are having a hard time financially, the fact that they aren't refunding these fees is particularly disappointing.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what you just mentioned in terms of their explanation that they are providing some of these services remotely, services like counseling, advising, telehealth, medical care. Is it possible to get some of that money back, but still be able to fund these services? Maybe some of these students really rely on these services that are being provided remotely, and if they have to refund all the money, they won't be able to provide these services.
And once again, what we're going to need to see and learn is exactly what the university systems are doing, what the university system's rationalization is or will be for its conduct so far. And once we see that, we'll actually know where the university systems are.
So as you said, you are not suing for a reimbursement of tuition, but I think a lot of students are pretty unhappy with the quality of education they're getting these days. They're not enjoying their classes as much. Maybe they say the quality isn't as good, the instruction is difficult, and they're just not getting what they paid for. So did you consider suing for a partial tuition refund?
We don't believe that a tuition refund case is the right thing to do. And here's why. They've tried to create an option using internet technology, be it Zoom, be it something else, to try to make the learning process continue as well as possible. Is it anyone's first choice? No, it's no one's first choice. No one wants to be in class on Zoom if they don't have to be. So I think when these schools, which are faced with a no-win situation, are trying to make the best of a bad situation, I think that a tuition refund claim is simply not the right thing to do. In contrast, however, when you are talking about campus fees and the like, it's an entirely different situation because those are actual fees that cannot go to the services that they were supposed to actually go to. So I think that you're really talking about apples and oranges.
Adam Leavitt, he's one of the attorneys in a class action lawsuit filed against the UC and Cal State systems, representing about 700,000 students asking for the return of campus fees. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's talk more about how COVID-19 is affecting colleges and universities and the tough economic reality they now face with Paul Tough, author of The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Well, it seems like most of us are pretty close to the breaking point when it comes to this. A lot of incoming college freshmen wondering if they're going to be going to school for the first time, going to college for the first time in August or September. A lot of existing college students wondering if they should go back. What do you think is going to happen in the next couple of months?
It is really hard to say. I think there are, colleges and students are all trying to figure it out together. I mean, I think the big decision that colleges are going to have to make over the next, I hope, month or two, is whether they are going to open classes in person in August or September. And I think that will have a big impact on students' decisions. I think there are a lot of students who are rethinking college already or thinking about a college that's closer to home or cheaper for financial reasons. And I think if colleges decide to go to an online model in the fall, there are many more students who will decide, let's skip it, let's take a year off, and won't start up that way.
Which then will just be another financial burden that the colleges and universities will have to deal with, right? I mean, already they're staggering. I believe that UC has just in the month of March announced $560 million or so of unanticipated costs. Like, how much longer can they hang on if fewer people enroll and the costs just keep mounting?
Yeah, the problem for higher institutions of higher education right now is that they have problems on all sides, financial problems on all sides, as well as just the academic problems they're dealing with. One of the things that became clear to me when I was reporting my book was that there are a small number of private colleges that have a ton of resources, Ivy League colleges, Stanford. They just have these huge endowments. They are fine no matter what happens. But you don't have to go too much further down the selectivity list to get to colleges that are in real financial trouble. So about a quarter of private nonprofit colleges are losing money every year, were already before this crisis, and many more are pretty close to that line. And so with this loss of revenue, with the refunds that some colleges are giving, they are going to be at a much more shaky ground already. That's affecting their admissions. That's affecting their ability to offer financial aid. It's affecting who they can admit. At the same time, public universities are about to face huge cutbacks, probably from state governments that are in real financial trouble all over the country. The combination of students who can't pay tuition and states that aren't willing to support those public institutions is going to be a huge financial burden.
Right. And so are you anticipating that some of these colleges are going to go out of business entirely?
Yeah, I don't think the public ones, most of the public ones will, and I'm hoping that states will find a way to keep supporting those institutions. But I do think that a larger number of private institutions will go broke or will vastly shift their model. There have been higher education experts predicting over the last few years that private colleges would go broke, and it hasn't really happened yet. There have been a few here and there, but not a lot. So it always seems unsafe to predict that that's going to continue to happen, but it is hard to imagine that we won't have a lot more college closings and bankruptcies in the year and a couple of years ahead.
Right. And what does this mean for students, especially low-income students? Maybe they are the first in their families to go to college. What does it mean for them? You just mentioned that many of these universities won't be able to offer as much financial aid.
Yeah, this is enormously difficult for them. I mean, I think in my book, I focused a lot on low-income first-generation students. And so a lot of them are just already facing financial trouble because their parents have lost jobs, because there's anxiety about traveling a long way, there's less tuition money to go around. But then at the same time, institutions have already been cutting financial aid for a lot of those low-income students and will now have to cut it much more severely. When I followed the admissions director at this one private college, Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and as he was trying to create a more diverse class, admit more low-income students, what really struck me watching him work was how much he had to keep his eye on the bottom line. And that meant admitting a lot more high-income students and a lot fewer low-income students than he would want. And so I can only imagine next year, as the financial pressures on institutions like that will be so much more extreme, it's just going to be harder and harder for those colleges to resist admitting students who can still pay tuition and to find the kind of funding they need to allow low-income students to go.
Mm. And for students who are already in college and considering a gap year, is that actually a big problem for the colleges to extend that year to say, okay, you can still be enrolled, but you can take a year off?
I mean, over the last decade or so, there's been a movement toward encouraging more students to, right after high school, take a gap year. And for some students, it's been a great option. I think next year there's going to be a lot more students who are doing it. And I think it does create financial problems for the colleges just as they're trying to figure out how to fill their seats, how to choose the right students who are going to actually show up and who are going to be able to pay tuition. It's one more uncertainty that they have to deal with. If you're a well-off kid who can spend the year, you know, doing service learning or traveling or doing some sort of independent project, that can often be a really good way to spend a gap year. If you are from a low-income family where your family's in financial trouble and you just need to spend the year working some low-wage job, the likelihood of you going back to college is quite low. And so that's the real worry. If students start making the decision right now not to go to college this fall, they may not get back for a long time.
Well, I guess the students are also in a big pickle when it comes to this idea of a gap year, because if they do take a gap year, whether they're financially well off or not, what are they going to do during this year? They're not going to go
exactly
off traveling necessarily, and they're definitely going to have a hard time finding a job.
Yeah, well, so I've talked to students who say, and this might be actually a smart move for a lot of them, that what they want to do is take community college classes, which might be online this year, and, you know, knock off some prerequisites, some sort of basic core curriculum classes for the college that they're going to at a much lower cost, and then re-enroll or defer their admission for a year and try to transfer those credits. There are downsides to that plan for a lot of students. It's sometimes hard to transfer those credits, but in some ways I think it's a choice that's going to make sense for a lot of students. If you're stuck at home taking a, you know, some sort of standard first year classes, why not take them at the least expensive option you can find?
Right. Well, so big picture, Paul, you've been thinking a lot about what colleges should be offering and what role they serve in our society. How do you think we're going to look at college education going forward?
I think the next few years are going to be really rough for a lot of students and a lot of institutions. You know, there have been other moments where we have had economic crises where students have actually gone to college in much higher numbers. That's what happened in the last recession. And in lots of ways, that's a good option, right? If there aren't jobs out there, you should go to college. We know that a college degree is still a really valuable thing. But as tuition has gone up and as, especially now, economic opportunity has gone down, I don't think that pattern is going to hold. I think we're going to continue to see declining student numbers over the next few years. And so I really worry about that because, you know, everything I wrote about in my book is about how college now is playing this role of creating wider divides in our society rather than narrowing those divides, rather than providing opportunity and mobility. And my worry is that's only going to get worse in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. Paul Tough, he's the author of The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I have some really great news for you because you have had some really great news for us. You guys have really pulled through on our Mission Critical fundraiser, and the giving has been through the roof, extraordinary, so much so that we are shortening our fundraiser by many, many days. So we are going to end it on Wednesday, hopefully Wednesday night. We need to raise $300,000 before then, though, so we've just got a couple of days to do that. And this is a risk, yeah, ending it early, but we know that you can pull through for us. If you haven't given already, now is definitely the time to do so. If you want to add a little bit more onto the existing pledge that you gave, well, you can do that as well. And if you want to renew your membership, now is the time. So lots of people making small donations to keep KCRW going. Go to kcrw.com/give. And when you do, you can choose the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank or the Food Bank of Santa Barbara and make twice the impact with your donation. kcrw.com/give. And let's do it before Wednesday. Coming up, LA Public Schools will start the new year in mid-August. We'll find out how distance learning is going. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles public schools will begin August 18th, as was the plan before the pandemic. LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner made that announcement today, but the district has not decided yet if classes will be online or in person. Buettner said a lot of testing and contact tracing would have to be in place before campuses reopen. Graduation next month, that will not be in person, and that's disappointing for a lot of seniors. Here's one who spoke with Buettner and several other teens during today's press conference. He wasn't identified.
People are starting to come around with the idea of a virtual graduation. Yes, it is frustrating because to hear that I've worked 12 plus years for a virtual graduation, very frustrating.
Well, Austin Buettner says summer school will be expanded for students having trouble distance learning, and the district will offer summer enrichment classes as well, like guitar lessons. For teachers, there will be more training to teach online. And let's talk about that now with Edward St. George. He teaches sixth grade social studies at Animo Jefferson Charter Middle School in South LA. And we spoke with Edward back in mid-March at the beginning of this whole remote learning experiment. Welcome back to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, when you and I spoke back then, it seemed like a century ago, but it was only about, 7 weeks ago, you said most of your students didn't have laptops or access to the internet at home. Has that changed?
Actually, yes. I'm really happy with how I work for a charter school, how they have gone about it. Right now, we have charter-wide distributed almost 8,000 Chromebooks to students and about 1,000 hotspots to students. So I know from my school site in particular, we should be at 100% connectivity, and it seems like the charter has made a real push to make sure that students have access to the internet.
And so how has that affected your teaching? Are you able to connect with most of your students?
So I'm still feeling like we have a ways to go with this connection for these students. Right now, our school is averaging about 80% attendance, which is still low. There are schools in our network who are at 98, 97, 95% attendance. But I feel like for our students, because we're middle school, and for me in particular with the sixth graders, there's still a lot of confusion and uncertainty and just a lack of clarity as to what they need and what's expected of them.
And that's coming from where? From the district? From where? From your principal?
The attendance.
The confusion and uncertainty about this.
So the students that I've spoken with, because we have been using Google Classroom and Google Meet, they still seem to be getting used to this idea. And last week was our first week of distance learning, so that's to be expected. Most of them were, or all of them were given a survey, and most of the students agreed that they were able to have this connection and were able to figure out Google Classroom. Just from my own personal experience, there have been a couple students that I have yet to hear from. But then there's also been many students who have been extremely active in their learning and sending me emails and contributing during our Google Meets and class time. So it's been kind of a mixed bag, and I guess that's just what I meant by this uncertainty, mm-hmm. is that it's not 100% across the board.
So last week was the first time you did this Google Classroom? That was the first time? And before that, you had just been handing out assignments, and they were just completing them by themselves?
So prior to last week, the students were basically, as I mentioned last time we spoke, doing a reading using books and assignments through our reading software and through our math software. But mm-hmm. up until last week, the teachers were working on this prep and this training for the switch to distance learning. So last week was the first week in which we as a school have been fully back to learning.
Today, Buettner announced a new initiative to get teachers trained beyond the basics of online instruction. And this initiative is called Future Ready Certification, and there are classes involved. Have you looked into this, and do you think that'll help you teach more effectively online?
I have not. It sounds like a great program. I think just because I am a part of the separate charter network, I wasn't aware of this opportunity. My charter network has been excellent in supporting teachers remotely through webinars and through professional development and through having our curriculum specialist reach out and give us kind of unit plans and lessons for that. So our school has really done an excellent job with bringing us up to speed and making sure that we are providing our students with the best possible learning that we can. I think these programs, like the one that Buettner was talking about, sound excellent. And I think especially with the trajectory of learning and the use of programs like Google Classroom, it's an invaluable skill for educators.
How do you get kids animated and involved when you're doing online distance learning and Google Classroom? Like, how do they not kind of zone out and get bored with this kind of setup?
Well, that's the hard part, isn't it? It's making sure that not only are they logged in and accessing the material, but it's also making sure that they're enjoying learning and having this love of learning even from a distance. I don't know if you watched the whole of Buettner's press conference, but the teacher who had the vacuum cleaner dances and getting engagement through activities like that, I thought was brilliant. For me, I've been having students create digital posters and share them with their families, and use programs like Flipgrid to create videos describing and presenting ancient Roman society. So there are lots of ways that educators can go and encourage this engagement. And I think that is one of the great things about distance learning is the access to the internet and all the different tools that are online. But again, it's just knowing which of those works best for your students and knowing your students well enough to make sure that they're still engaged and enjoying learning.
And so if the district decides that come August 18th, it's not ready to open up classrooms, you'll be okay with that?
So for me, I'm struggling with distance learning in that I miss the personal aspect of teaching and of school. But I think the best thing to do is to keep in mind that there is a reason for this distance learning. There is a reason for the quarantine and wearing face masks, and it is for the safety of others and for our communities. And so I'm not happy with the idea of teaching more from an online platform, but when keeping that in mind and the bigger picture and looking at the positives that come out of this distance learning and the health and safety it promotes, I think that I'm glad they're being as cautious as they are.
Edward St. George teaches sixth grade social studies at Animo Jefferson Charter Middle School in South LA. Edward, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, for the first time, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a teleconference.
For some reason, it just felt so much more immediate and more intimate, and it really did feel like a historic moment.
The Legal Eagle listened in. Jessica Levinson will be here to say how it went next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Supreme Court made history today. After a two-month hiatus because of the coronavirus, the justices reconvened today to hear oral arguments in a conference call. And that wasn't the only first for the court today. The public was able to listen in on the arguments, too, technical difficulties and all.
Justice Sotomayor? Justice Sotomayor?
I'm sorry, Chief.
Okay, so it appeared that she did not have her microphone on, but then she figured that out. And while this might not seem like a big deal to those of us who have spent the last month or so on some kind of never-ending conference call, or at least that's what it feels like, it's a monumental step for the traditional and secretive court. Jessica Levinson is here to talk about this. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi.
So you listened in. What did you think? How did it go?
I did. You know, I woke up really early and I thought, oh, I'll probably listen. And, you know, I wasn't that excited. And then I heard them real time. And for some reason, it just felt so much more immediate and more intimate. And it really did feel like a historic moment. And you had these kind of humanizing moments like we just heard where Justice Sotomayor, like the rest of us, couldn't find the unmute button. And I thought it was actually very educational. It was really easy to follow the arguments. And it, you know, it felt to me like, why haven't we been doing this for decades now? It would be so easy.
Well, why haven't we been doing this for decades? Other countries do it. Other countries let the public listen in on in real time.
Other countries do it. Other federal judges do it. Other state judges do it. So certainly there are plenty of hearings across America that you can live stream. And so it's interesting why we don't. Basically, every Supreme Court justice before they get on the bench during the confirmation hearing says something like, wouldn't it be fantastic if we had more transparency? I would love to educate the public about what we do. And then the moment they get on the court, they say some version of, you know, people would just be performing and it would take the, you know, very important legal issues and put those to the side, and it would make it more of a spectacle, or people would take it out of context, or people wouldn't have read the briefs, and so they wouldn't really understand what's going on. And it's all some version of, we'd rather not have to basically, you know, look pretty or sound a certain way for the television cameras in the courtroom.
But they are available, or the arguments are available or have been available later. What's the difference between doing it in real time and doing it later?
Yes, I can't put my finger on exactly what felt different. It's not like I could have jumped in and said something. I mean, I was very much just a participator like everybody else. But it really did feel much more like I was on the phone with them, like we were all in the same virtual room. It just felt more immediate.
And is there a different procedure now? Because I know when they're all together at the court, they all kind of jump in when they feel like it, right? That's kind of a free-for-all.
It is so much of a free-for-all that recently Chief Justice John Roberts actually had to implement a two-minute rule to say to his colleagues, every litigant gets 2 minutes to talk in uninterrupted, and then you can jump in. And today was different, where the court started in order of seniority. So it was Chief Justice John Roberts, the first among equals, who went first. And then, in a really shocking twist, it was Clarence Thomas, who hasn't spoken on the court really in a year. Before that, I think it was years. And we actually got to hear from each of the justices, and they still interacted. So you heard the justices kind of piggyback on each other, much like we do in a conference call.
And the case they heard today, I know it's not a big case, but briefly, what was it?
Yeah, the case dealt with trademarks and whether or not you can trademark a otherwise generic name by adding .com to it. So the question is, for booking.com, you could never trademark the word booking because that's just way too generic to fall within the statute to allow people to say, yes, I get a federal monopoly law on that, essentially. But if you add .com, does it take on a whole new meaning such that it actually could be trademarked? And that was the question. This was also rare. It was two female lawyers who were on each side. And I thought it was a very well-received argument.
All right, let's turn to a big story here in California. And that is whether or not beaches and localities can reopen in defiance of the governor's orders. Late on Friday, a judge rejected a request from Huntington Beach and Dana Point to block the governor's order to close their beaches. And that case, though, is continuing. So what's next?
What's next is that the state has to go into court and basically show cause, show enough evidence as to why this order should be in place. What happened Friday is that the localities just said, we want a temporary restraining order. You can't implement this for the weekend, which is basically going in and saying, I need emergency relief. And what the court said on Friday is, you don't need emergency relief, but maybe you do need a bit more evidence. So let's go through a normal process, asking the state to say why this is necessary.
So who does have the power when it comes to opening and closing these beaches? Sure, there are city beaches and ostensibly under the purview of the cities, but can the governor then swoop in and say, no cities, you've got to close down?
He can, as long as he has a good reason for doing it and his order to close it down is basically well-tailored enough to solve a real problem. So the answer is that the governor absolutely can do that. So the state can basically set a floor, and counties and cities can decide to go further to be more protective, but not to be less protective.
Okay, finally, federal judge tossed out a lawsuit brought by the U.S. women's soccer team, and the team had claimed that they were discriminated against by the U.S. Soccer Federation because they were paid less than the men's team. Why did the judge toss that lawsuit?
The judge actually tossed that part of the lawsuit pretty close to when trial was going to start, I believe, next month, saying that the women's team had structured their compensation in a way that was different, so that they were guaranteed compensation over a longer period of time. It might have been lower, but he said over certain periods, they actually got more compensation than the men's team. He basically said, just because you structured something in a different way doesn't mean that what you received was discriminatory. It doesn't mean that it rises to the legal level.
Okay, finally, Jessica, a.k.a. Legal Eagle, we have to announce that we have a new podcast. It's you and me. It's called The Legal Eagle Files, and it's basically we take on a legal issue, have some fun on the way, and it's really fantastic to talk to you for a longer period of time. So I hope everyone checks it out wherever they get their podcasts.
I'm so excited about this. This latest episode that drops tomorrow, Tuesday, I'm not sure I'm hip enough to say drops, but let's go with it, talks about voting during the time of pandemic. And it also talks about your twin obsessions, which is a online spelling game, and your Peloton.
Check out more of that online, wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, KCRW. Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School and, of course, our regular Legal Eagle and co-host of The Legal Eagle Files. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
All right, some good news. We are going to end our Mission Critical fundraiser this Wednesday. So that gives you, what, 2 days to get in on this? And you know why we're ending it early? We're ending it like a week and a half early because so many of you have decided to donate to KCRW and keep us going because we have kept going during this whole crazy time, providing you with the news, the information, the music, the cultural programs that you have come to rely on. And we're here for you. You're here for us. It's just a great partnership. So you have a couple more days. If you haven't come in yet to the tent, welcome. Come on in. Any amount gets you in, but we're looking for about $20 a month if you can swing that. And also when you do, you can also support the LA Regional Food Bank and the Food Bank of Santa Barbara. So kcrw.com/give. Coming up, a music appreciation of Star Wars. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. John Williams' iconic Imperial March from the Star Wars saga. We first heard it back in 1980 in The Empire Strikes Back as Darth Vader stood on the bridge of his ship, contemplating his obsessive and unceasing search for Luke Skywalker. It's the standard by which all movie villain themes are judged, or at least since 1980. That's the argument of my guest, Frank Lehman. He says the bad guys in Star Wars get the best tunes. He teaches music theory at Tufts University. That's just outside Boston. He's also a Star Wars super fan who curates an online catalog of the musical themes and motifs from the series. Welcome to the program, Frank Lehman.
Thanks so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Great to have you. Well, so why do the villains get the best tunes?
Well, everyone wants to root for the bad guy sometimes, and it's a great technique to make their themes memorable, to leave the audience humming along with the baddies, who are so often the most striking and interesting characters in this series. You know, the heroes tend to be a little bit, you know, maybe milquetoast, mm-hmm. and the villains are the ones that are exciting to the audience, and their music is written accordingly to make it catchy and infectious and maybe a little bit seductive.
Right. Well, I guess in all movies, the villains are more interesting.
I think that's generally true. Yeah, certainly for Star Wars.
So when it comes to the music, this is all written by John Williams, right?
That's right.
And when he is creating a piece of music for a villain, is he working closely with George Lucas, or in this case, J.J. Abrams, to sort of create the character through the music?
I think that's a great way of putting it, that these characters really are inconceivable without their musical accompaniments. Back in Episode 4, or as it was known then, Star Wars, the first one in 1977, there actually wasn't a particularly memorable theme for any of the major villains. You know, there was a kind of imperial motif, but it was rather understated and not quite as catchy. And then in 1980, with Empire Strikes Back, Williams did write this incredible earworm, which is the Imperial March, which is so insistent and overwhelming on the soundtrack that it kind of browbeats you into enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Do you enjoy it?
Oh, I get a lot of pleasure out of these scores. I study them, and sometimes I wonder if I've heard these things too often and too many times, but every listen, every watch, I hear something new, and that's likely to be true with The Rise of Skywalker as well.
And did George Lucas intend for the music to be as iconic as it has become?
Well, like so many things in Star Wars, everything was a bit of an accident initially. Williams himself wasn't aware that there would ever be a sequel to the first movie, let alone a sequel trilogy or a prequel trilogy, right? He would have thought one was enough. And the initial plan on Lucas's behalf was to use pre-existing classical music. This would have been on the model of 2001 Space Odyssey, which had come out a few years earlier. And that's what Lucas thought he wanted for Star Wars. And his good friend at the time, Steven Spielberg, convinced him that he would be better suited with an originally composed movie score. And he recommended his friend John Williams, who had just worked with him on a little movie called Jaws 2 years earlier. And together, Williams and Spielberg were able to convince Lucas that, no, this picture would be much better suited by music that maybe in some ways captures the spirit of some of that pre-existing music that Lucas had envisioned initially to accompany the movie. But rather than just ape an earlier style, it could actually evolve along with the characters and suggest new things and be a kind of unique identifier for this movie.
Well, getting back to the Imperial March, Darth Vader's theme, as you say, it's a very powerful, iconic theme. But by the end of the original trilogy, Darth Vader is dying and his son, Luke Skywalker, unmasks him. And we hear the Imperial March, but it's different. So you hear the solo harp there. Tell us about this iteration.
Yeah, it's one of the most, I think, stunning musical transformations in the entire series, all 9 scores now. Up to that point, every instance that we'd heard of Darth Vader's theme had been, well, imperious, overwhelming, loud, militaristic. And finally, when we see him on his deathbed, this pathetic, ruined, regretful old man, Williams totally deconstructs the theme. He strips away all of the militaristic garb. There's no more brass. There's no more snare drums. Instead, we get a succession of these sort of solo instruments or very light strings. And finally, this absolutely stripped down, pathetic version for harp, which is it doesn't resolve in a major key, but there is a sense of finality to it, which goes along with the idea of redemption that's so important in this series. It's a really astonishing musical transformation, and something that Williams has often talked about what a gift it is to be able to return to these themes and to transform them and to show new sides to them. And this is certainly an opportunity that he realized with Vader's theme.
Well, let us move up to the present then and talk about Darth Vader's grandson, Kylo Ren, played by Adam Driver. Here's his theme. Okay, very brash. What do you hear there?
Yeah, it's a kind of statement of musical bravado. The theme itself is actually quite short. It's only about 2 measures long, and that can be repeated, but in its way, it's rather stunted. It never quite achieves this massive, long-lived musical statement that Vader's model, which I think is what Kylo Ren is attempting to capture physically and visually, but also musically, sonically. It never quite achieves the heights that Vader's theme does. And I think this is a nice character insight on Williams' part. It's aggressive and in your face, but in its own way, kind of a concealment or a mask that we understand, because this is so overt and over the top, but yet not quite as self-assured and not quite as developed as Vader's theme, that Kylo Ren is kind of a character in process, that this dark side facade that we hear in the music is maybe not the whole story. It's not exactly a carbon copy of Darth Vader's music.
Do you think that his theme will evolve as he does?
I think it will. It's difficult to say exactly what Williams has up his sleeve, but we have heard hints of possible developments and transformations of Kylo Ren's material, particularly in The Last Jedi. Towards the end of that film, when Kylo Ren has kind of been bested by Luke Skywalker, humiliated, he's marching through the abandoned rebel base, and we hear a big martial rah-rah statement of his theme that seems as though finally Kylo Ren is in his element and we're going to get this long four-square full march statement. And yet the thing just dissolves before reaching closure. It's a beautiful moment. It reminds us that he's just been defeated in a really deep and humiliating way, that there's no victory. It's a Pyrrhic victory for him, that the moral victory has been on the side of the light, and he's not done. He's not done achieving full villain status.
He will be back. As another famous villain.
There is a promise.
That's right. All right, finally, the darkest of the Darksiders, the Emperor's theme. Okay, Frank, what do you hear there?
I think this is maybe Williams' musical masterstroke in illustrating villainy, because the music is not in your face or overt in any way. This is actually a quite subtle theme, almost invariably stated by a low, male, wordless choir. That's kind of the Emperor's voice in the musical score, this deep, brooding basso sort of ensemble. But what really makes this theme special is the harmonies, the way that each chord moves to one another, that there's no real sense of a straightforward, natural logic to the way that the chords move from point A to point B. It's very unpredictable. It's perverse in a way. It's a violation of what we expect. So the combination of this deep, ominous, almost liturgical or religious sounding choir with the extremely perverse and deceptive sorts of harmonies makes, I think, a pretty unmistakably powerful, insinuating sort of theme.
It appears this series will go on and on and on because, well, why would you turn down the opportunity to make a ton of money? But John Williams is not a young man. So what does the future look like without John Williams?
Well, I frankly think it's quite exciting to see what the musical universe of Star Wars will sound like after Williams stops working on the series. And there, I think the best thing that could happen would be for a composer to maybe capture some small element of what makes a Star Wars musical soundtrack, a Star Wars soundtrack, but to project it through their own voice, to not feel totally straitjacketed by what has been established by Williams, because no one really can do that. No one can write like Williams, but people can write like themselves, and I think this has been demonstrated quite nicely with some recent entries into the franchise, like The Mandalorian, which has wonderful music by Ludwig Göransson that's just quite outside the prior established Star Wars lexicon of themes and so on. And I think the score for Solo, too, even though it wasn't quite a box office smash, John Powell's work on that was quite interesting and forward-thinking and did a nice job of synthesizing what Williams has done with a much more modern sensibility in terms of orchestration and the way that electronics and drums and guitars are inserted into the mix.
Frank Lehman is a music professor at Tufts University and a Star Wars super fan, too. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in case you forgot what day it is today, it is May the 4th, as in, may the 4th be with you. My producers made me say that. Okay, seriously, the 4th, I mean, the Force, has been with us here at KCRW because we are ending our Mission Critical fundraiser early because of you. You guys are the force that has powered us through and really come through during our fundraiser. So we're going to cut it short on Wednesday, but we still need to raise around $300,000 to make our goal. And we think we can do that in the next couple of days with your help at kcrw.com/give. Lots of great thank you gifts there, including lots of new cool swag, including a KCRW bookworm tote. It's really cute. Go check it out. Anyway, the important thing to do is to become a member, renew your membership, or upgrade your membership by going online at kcrw.com/give. Thank you so much for pulling through for us, for being our own KCRW force. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.